Welcome to The Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. This is the final episode of Season 1 of The Breach, but we'll be back with Season 2 on July 11th. If you're enjoying the show, please rate us and review us on iTunes. My guest today is Adam Serwer, whose name you may recognize from last week's recommended reading segment on Montana's newest and most aggro member of Congress, Greg Gianforte. Adam is a senior editor at The Atlantic covering politics. He's here today to talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' radical vision for the Department of Justice, which threatens everything from civil rights enforcement in federal agencies, to sentencing reform, to bathroom access for transgender students. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeff Sessions has promised a new era at the Justice Department. What does that look like in practice?
Well, I think in particular for civil rights advocates, what they're seeing is changes in priorities regarding enforcement, but also a shrinking of the department. The new budget estimates, a loss of several attorneys and about more than 100 workers. In general, the attitude of the Trump administration has been one of saying they don't want to intrude on local jurisdictions. They don't want to do oversight of police departments, and they're particularly concerned with immigration law, and they view employers hiring undocumented immigrants as a form of discrimination. So it's a pretty big shift from the Obama administration. And in particular, if you look at things like the office of, a lot of different departments have their own offices that deal with civil rights things. The Department of Education has one that's very important. The Health and Human Services has one that's very important. And you can see at HHS, they're sort of shifting more towards religious exemptions for requirements and health insurance.
So making sure nuns aren't quote-unquote discriminated against because they're associated with a health insurance policy that provides birth control and that kind of stuff?
Right. I mean, I would say that that's like the minimal. I mean, the rumor that has been reported, or, the thing that's been reported, is that they're thinking about extending the exemption to anyone who any employer who doesn't want to cover birth control, not simply religious employers. So, in general, what we're seeing is a very different approach on civil rights from the Obama era, which had a very sort of aggressive approach to enforcement.
What does the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department do? What do they focus on?
Well, they do a lot of things. I mean, the Civil Rights Division is the part of the Justice Department that's primarily focused on looking into abuses by local police jurisdictions and is empowered to go in there and find that there are systemic problems with the police department and compel that police department to go into a court-supervised agreement to fix whatever systemic problems are there. They deal with housing. They deal with voting. They deal with employment discrimination. They're not the only ones, of course. There's also the EEOC. But in general, the Justice Department Civil Rights Division is very significant in terms of civil rights enforcement in the country. They're the primary agency in the Justice Department charged with enforcing civil rights laws.
Can you expand on what Sessions' attitude towards consent decrees is and how that's going to affect how police departments around the country actually deal with citizens on a day-to-day basis?
Well, so those court-supervised agreements that I mentioned earlier, they're known as consent decrees. And Sessions' basic view towards the kind of lawsuits that the Obama administration was engaging in, where they'd sue a police department and they'd investigate it and they'd say that you have these systemic problems with racial profiling or use of force or, de-escalation problems. And then they'd go to a court and they'd sort of hash out an agreement, and the court would supervise the police department's efforts to sort of get in compliance with the Constitution. Sessions testified during his confirmation hearing that he just thinks that these consent decrees aren't a good idea because they hurt morale for police officers. So, and for him, that's much more important than whether or not there's some sort of systemic discrimination going on.
Is there any evidence that they do, in fact, hurt the morale of police officers? I mean, I know police officers don't like them and grumble about them, but has anybody actually done the HR work to prove that they're less satisfied with their jobs if they're working under one?
Well, I actually don't know the answer to that question, but I mean, certainly in some cases, departments have recognized that they have serious problems and have, you know, complied with these agreements and have been not reluctant to do so. I mean, one of the things that Sessions did early on was he tried to get out of a consent decree with the police department in Baltimore, and the political leadership in Baltimore and the police leadership was basically like, no, we want to move forward with this.
And how good is it for morale to be known as the most racist police department? That can't be fun to go to work.
That certainly, you know, those, the reputations of police departments are important in terms of their relationships with the community, and to the extent that they improve those relationships, the consent decrees improve those relationships, I think particularly police leadership might, if not be happy about them, certainly consider them important or helpful. But it wouldn't be surprising if most police officers don't like being told that they're doing their job poorly. Nobody likes that. But there's, you know, there is a more important issue at stake here in the perspective of civil rights advocates, which is that police officers shouldn't be allowed to violate the Constitution. And if they have a pattern of doing so, then they need supervision to make sure that they don't keep doing that.
And the Obama administration was crystal clear about that, right? They said, you know, this is normative guidance from the federal government, and if you're doing your job worse because of it, it's on you to keep doing your job at the former standard, because this is just how police officers have to behave in this country.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that the Obama administration, even the reports that were scathing, were very sympathetic towards police officers. But, you know, what they emphasized was that police officers are, you know, government officials. They have a certain responsibility to respect the constitutional rights of the people that they deal with, regardless of who they are. And a failure to do that can really harm the police's relationship with the community, but also, you know, their legitimacy. If there's a sense that the police are not bound by the rule of law, then the community is more likely to see them as a hostile entity that is, you know, the people that they need to call when they're in trouble.
Sessions has claimed at various times that consent decrees actually increase crime. Is there any evidence to support that conjecture?
I have never seen any evidence to that effect, but I think it's, you know, part of Sessions' general attitude, which is that when you criticize police officers, they react by pulling back, and therefore crime gets worse. And again, this is sort of related to the Ferguson effect, which I think even, you know, James Comey said that the Ferguson effect was real. There isn't actually a lot of quantitative evidence for that view. But even if there were, constitutional rights are constitutional rights.
Yeah. And what has Sessions been doing in the area of drug policy lately?
Well, the truth is that Sessions, he's done some things that are very significant, and he hasn't done other things that people might have expected him to do. Mm-hmm. He's directed prosecutors to seek the harshest punishments for federal drug crimes, you know, which is a reversal of more lenient Obama-era guidelines. And that's obviously going to have a huge effect on people, because it means that federal prosecutors will be seeking the harshest possible penalties for crimes that maybe aren't that serious.
So the Obama administration had flagged certain kinds of nonviolent drug offenses for more lenient treatment, and now that's going away. Is that a correct synopsis?
Yeah. And Sessions is known as, you know, an ardent drug warrior. What he hasn't done yet is he hasn't gone after the states that have legalized marijuana. And, you know, that's something people were concerned about. Sessions has said that good people don't smoke marijuana, and has generally had a dim view of marijuana throughout his career, both as a prosecutor and as a senator, but that hasn't happened yet. But certainly the sentencing guidelines are going to make things very difficult for a lot of families who are going to see their loved ones locked up, in some cases for things that aren't, you know, a huge threat to public safety.
Is this the kind of policy change that's going to disproportionately affect certain people, like people of color?
I think it is going to disproportionately affect people of color, because people of color are more heavily policed, but it's not like it's not going to affect white people. A significant percentage of people in federal prison are meth users who tend to be white. The drug war affects people of color, just doesn't only affect people of color. And I think, it's possible to hold both those thoughts at the same time, definitely. Right? That even though people of color may be more drastically affected, they're not going to be the only one.
Yeah. It's a burden on our entire society, and then certain people within that are even more disproportionately affected. Are the people expecting that Sessions is going to end up reversing the decline in federal prison populations that occurred under the Obama administration?
No, I mean, he's almost certainly going to increase it based on his guidelines. He also reversed a late Obama-era push to sort of stop relying on private prisons. So I think Sessions is a believer that harsher law enforcement is better law enforcement, and that's going to be reflected in the prison population.
What are the prospects for medical marijuana as a subset of our legal marijuana industries? Are people concerned that that's going to be vulnerable under Sessions?
I think that, you know, Sessions has obviously, he doesn't, despite favoring local control on a lot of civil rights matters, I don't think he feels that way about marijuana. But I also think that politically, marijuana legalization is really popular. And it's one of those things that Sessions, either he might be taking his time because he knows it's something that could lead to a backlash, or he just might let that one go precisely because it could motivate some of Trump's own voters to turn on him.
And it's kind of ironic. I mean, one of Trump's most staunch supporters in Congress is Rohrabacher of the Rohrabacher Fire Amendment, which, you know, is kind of a hands-off deal for enforcement of federal marijuana laws as long as it's medical. So they may have internal reasons within their own camp not to want to push this too far.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, marijuana is also, you know, now that it's been legalized in certain places, there's, it's becoming an organized industry that is gaining political clout and knows how to wield it. So I think while Sessions, I think, would like to ramp up enforcement against states that have legalized marijuana, he might not do it for political reasons or because he has other priorities that mean more to him.
What would happen if he actually decided to take on the $7 billion legal marijuana industry? Would it end up in the federal courts? What would you anticipate would be the actual denouement if he's like, okay, we're going to get tough on this?
I mean, it sort of depends on exactly, you know, how he decided to do it. But I do think that you could expect a protracted legal battle that wouldn't, I'm speculating at this point, but I think, you know, the sort of federal power versus state power question, it's hard to, you know, the impacts of those kinds of rulings aren't always immediately obvious.
Yeah, it could be really far reaching in ways that Sessions doesn't want, like, you know, giving in general more federal control against the states because he's supposed to be such a committed federalist.
Right. So, like, I mean, you look at the sanctuary city stuff, you know, obviously when the Supreme Court ruled in the Obamacare decision, they made the Medicaid expansion optional, and millions of people didn't get health care because of that. But that decision also probably made it impossible for Trump to significantly punish cities that don't want to be deputized into enforcing federal immigration laws because they have other priorities, because that ruling said that the federal government can't be coercive in withholding funding from states to get them to do what they want. So, you know, whenever you have like a sort of big kind of federal state litigation thing, like going after medical marijuana would turn into, the consequences of those kinds of rulings are not always immediately obvious.
Do you think that might be one reason why he's holding back, that he doesn't like the legal implications of what a win would mean for his own agenda?
It's possible, but I don't know.
Sessions has announced that he's going to treat the hiring of undocumented workers as a form of discrimination against those who are legally entitled to work in the U.S. How's that going to play out in practice?
So technically the law bars discrimination against workers on the basis of nationality. And now the idea behind that, when it was originally passed in the 80s, it was passed with the Ronald Reagan immigration reform stuff. The idea was to make it so that employers who assumed that people who could work legally in the United States couldn't work legally in the United States. If they, you know, they assumed they were foreigners because they were Asian or they were Latino or something, or they spoke with an accent. I mean, generally, that's how that law has been used. But technically, it's about nationality. So it could be used against employers who are, quote unquote, discriminating against American workers. But,
and they would call it hiring someone who's undocumented would be legally counted as discriminating against someone who has the legal right to work here, just prima facie.
I don't know how it would work in practice, but that was the implication of the federal budget summary for the Civil Rights Division mm-hmm. when it was discussing enforcement of employment discrimination law. And, you know, there's already, you know, we already have a federal immigration enforcement apparatus whose job it is to prevent employers from hiring undocumented immigrants. So it'd be weird to also turn the Civil Rights Division's resources towards that end. But that's, you know, that's what the budget says it wants to do. So
theoretically, the Justice Department could be stepping on toes elsewhere in the federal government if it ramps up its immigration enforcement?
I don't know that they would be stepping on toes. I think ICE is very... the rank and file at Immigration and Customs Enforcement feels empowered and they feel good about it. And I don't think that, you know, again, I'm not sure how much of this is actually going to take priority in practice, but certainly it's budgets are statements of values. And this one certainly says something about the administration's values.
And how much of this do you think is likely to be able to get actually funded through Congress?
Congress, a lot of influential lawmakers have said the budget is dead on arrival. You know, the question of funding, baseline funding, the truth is that Jeff Sessions as Attorney General has a lot of power to set priorities for his agency, regardless of how it's funded. So while there may not be as big a cut to the Civil Rights Division, ultimately, when the budget gets passed, certainly what he is, or his, you know, the person he's placed in charge of the Civil Rights Division wants to do whatever those priorities are, they're certainly going to be different from the ones that existed in the Obama administration. And there's a lot of leeway for them to decide what those are.
One of Sessions' first acts upon becoming Attorney General was to revoke guidance about bathrooms and other kinds of civil rights for trans students in public schools. Can you talk a bit about that and the implications of those changes?
You know, Sessions has been a strong opponent of LGBT rights for a long time. He didn't like the Supreme Court ruling. He didn't like Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court ruling that overturned the criminalization of homosexual sex. I mean, generally, he would say that, you know, this is a local issue and local jurisdictions should be able to decide it. But of course, you know, the reason why the Civil Rights Division exists is to make sure that local jurisdictions aren't violating the sort of fundamental constitutional rights of the people who live there. And I think when it comes to LGBT rights, the fact is that this administration is going to have other priorities in terms of enforcement. And that, you know, in the case of trans kids, that's obviously going to have real consequences.
Are there other policy changes that have implications for LGBT rights under Sessions?
Well, I mean, not that I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, certainly it's going to, you know, they're reviewing all the consent decrees that are in force already that might have to do with trans rights, with schools that might have to do with trans rights or LGBT rights more broadly. Certainly when it comes to, you know, other areas of discrimination with schools like Title IX or something like that, it's actually difficult to express how many different areas of civil rights enforcement having someone who is, you know, generally believes in a hands-off approach to that sort of thing is going to affect millions and millions of people in terms of how the rights are protected.
We've been seeing a really alarming uptick in bias crimes, like the stabbings in Portland and the murder in Maryland, and before that, a racially motivated killing in New York by a white supremacist. Do you feel like the Sessions Justice Department is adequately placed to deal with an uptick in that kind of violence?
Well, so, you know, I would say that Sessions, generally federal officials, except in notable, there are obviously notable exceptions, but generally when there's like a murder like that, they usually let local jurisdictions handle it. Sometimes when it's particularly heinous, the federal government will step in. I mean, Sessions is certainly, you know, one of his early cases, he was involved in, not to the extent that he claimed to be involved in it, but he was certainly involved in the prosecution of white supremacists for the lynching of a young black man in Alabama in the 80s. So he's not, you know, he's not entirely hostile to the idea of the federal government taking a hand in dealing with violence. That's not Sessions's weakest point in terms of civil rights enforcement. You know, in terms of responding to bias crimes, if I were looking at the federal government and an inadequate response to those things, I would probably look higher than Sessions.
And the budget seemed to not place a very high priority on funding, fighting discrimination against disabled people. Can you talk about what the federal government has been doing and what would have to change if the Trump budget went through?
I don't know about what would have to change, but I think in general, disability rights advocates are really alarmed by the Trump administration, not simply because, you know, this civil rights division budget, I mean, disability rights was a big priority for the Obama administration. The last budget request for the Obama administration has long sections about disability rights and things that they want to do in terms of disability rights enforcement. And the Trump budget for, you know, the following year has nothing.
Nothing at all?
There's nothing at all in it about disability rights, which, you know, communicates certainly that those are not a particular priority for the civil rights division under Trump. But I think the big sort of four alarm fire for disability rights advocates is the American Health Care Act, because so much of Medicaid goes towards helping people with disabilities, and also the Trump budget cuts the Social Security disability. So there's like, in terms of disability rights advocates, it's not just federal enforcement of anti-discrimination law that worries them. They're worried about a lot of things across the board.
How would America look different if you were to just say, okay, let's say in thought experiment, Trump gets what he wants in his budget, and vis-a-vis the Department of Justice, how would America look different in 3.5 years?
I mean, I wouldn't venture to guess what America is going to look like in a couple years. I'm not sure that how many people thought that it was going to look like this 2 years ago.
Indeed.
But certainly, you know, laws, in particular civil rights laws, have had a strong cultural effect on the United States. I mean, you know, when the Civil Rights Act was first passed, discrimination was the law of the land, you know, half of the country. And laws can be strong statements of values, even if you're not suing every individual person for not integrating their restaurant. The fact that there's a law that says discrimination is wrong actually, I think, means a great deal in terms of the way that people change their behavior. And certainly if across the country there's the sense that discrimination is no longer, whether it's racial, whether it's gender, whether it's sexual orientation, whether it's gender identity, if there's no longer a sense that these are things that the federal government takes interest in or cares about, that is going to affect people's behavior in the same way that passing the Civil Rights Act in the first place affected the behavior of people who were never faced a lawsuit because of discrimination or faced any kind of federal enforcement action.
Recently, you wrote a really great essay that we featured on the program last week called The Lesser Part of Valor. Can you talk a bit about how the values around freedom of the press have eroded in the Trump era and how that intersects with the violence?
Well, I think, you know, I want to be careful about making the press the central victim of the Trump administration. I think in general, reporters, especially these days.
The central victims of the war on the press, like not on the war on society, but he has declared specifically on the press. Not that they're the biggest victims of all.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest issue there and the thing that I would say to people about it is that it's not really about the press. The fact is that if Trump can curtail what the press says about him, then he's actually just curtailing what anybody says about him. You know, there's not.
Yeah.
you know, freedom of speech doesn't just cover reporters. And so, you know, the incident in Montana where Greg Gianforte attacked Guardian reporter Ben Jacobs physically and Republicans more or less shrugged about it, I think, you know, and, you know, other people, particularly conservative media personalities, cheered Gianforte on. I think that sends a message that violence is acceptable as long as you win. And that's just going to have profound consequences for our political culture if people think that it's okay to attack people because you're not going to suffer any political consequences for it. I mean, one of the big checks on violence in our political arguments is the idea that you would pay a price if you resorted to those kinds of tactics. And the fact that Gianforte, you know, attacked a reporter and then won, albeit in a Trump district, it certainly says something about the extent to which political violence is growing more acceptable.
Adam, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay.
And now it's time for recommended reading. Each week on The Breach, I highlight some reading material to take you beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the Trump administration's policies and the people who make them. This week's selection comes from Alec McGillis of ProPublica in the New York Times Magazine. It's called Jared Kushner's Other Real Estate Empire, and it's about the moldering apartment complexes that Trump's son-in-law presides over in Baltimore. Records show that Kushner is a neglectful and litigious landlord whose lawyers routinely sue poor tenants for frivolous reasons while leaving their units in disrepair. Note that the Trump budget would defund the Legal Services Corporation, the premier source of civil legal aid for low-income people. Housing law is one of the LSC's biggest portfolios. LSC lawyers help poor people to stand up to abusive landlords like Kushner. If more ordinary people can dispute frivolous lawsuits, it's money out of Kushner's pocket. That's it for recommended reading. Thanks for joining us for Season 1 of The Breach, and we look forward to bringing you more great content in Season 2, starting on July 11th. If you haven't subscribed yet, please take a moment to do so you won't miss a single episode. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Valetti. Our producer is Nora Hurley. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein, on Twitter. See you next week!